From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and this is it. Today is the court-ordered deadline for children and parents recently separated at the border to be reunited, and it appears the government is not going to make that deadline. You remember President Trump's policy criminalized everyone illegally crossing the border, even those seeking asylum. So more than 2,500 children had to be removed, which wasn't well documented, so it's been a logistical nightmare. Efren Olivares is a lawyer with the Texas Civil Rights Project, which represents more than 300 parents separated from their children. He's outside the federal courthouse in McAllen, Texas. Efren, what's your sense of how reunification is going?
Well, it's going very chaotically. It's been very disorganized, and it confirms what we've suspected all along, that when the government started separating families, they had no plan in place whatsoever. Out of the 382 parents and families that we represent, we have been able to confirm that 73 were reunited and released. 26 more have been reunited in detention, and at least 75 are still in adult detention facilities, so necessarily they're not with their children. And 6 parents, at least, that we represent, have been deported without their children. Their children remain at an ORR shelter in the U.S.
Well, and what happens there? Because we understand that's one of the biggest problems, is that hundreds of parents have been deported without their children, some of them because they were told in these quick interviews that they had with lawyers that that was the easiest way for them to get their children back.
Absolutely. We've been able to locate 2 of our 6 clients who were deported to Guatemala and Honduras, and they've told us that they didn't want to leave their children behind, that they want their children with them. They were led to believe that if they signed a voluntary departure to be deported expeditedly, they would get their children quickly, and they didn't. Now it's weeks later, and they still don't have their children. Their children remain in the U.S.
We'll talk about how this works, because we understand the government shuttles kids from shelters where they've been all across the country to the parking lots of detention centers where their parents are, and then the children are handed over to these nonprofits, non-governmental faith-based groups that help them get to a destination. Maybe it's raising money to buy a ticket to fly them home. That seems actually awfully odd that the government's handing children over to NGOs, who are, you know, wonderful organizations, but still seems kind of odd. And then they house them, clothe them, or send them home. Tell us how it works.
It's incredibly challenging for civil society organizations, for nonprofits like ours, to deal with the federal bureaucracies of ICE, of CBP, of the Office of Refugee Resettlement to try to get these families reunited. Not only because of a resource constraint, but also because the process is very slow and complicated and confusing for these parents. Now, from the government's perspective, it should be a lot easier because they are supposed to have all the databases, all the information of where the children and their parents are. So it's a matter of political will and putting the resources necessary to reunite them immediately.
But they don't have. That's what we've discovered, right? They don't really have the data.
Apparently, they don't have enough data or enough matched data to connect children to the parents they were separated from to be able to meet this deadline.
What happens if parents want to stay and seek asylum?
So for them, they will continue to pursue their asylum claims from the destination where they are being released to. And we are trying our best to make sure that they have enough legal support. But we're based here in Texas, and these families are going to Virginia, Chicago, Boston, L.A. It's really challenging.
One of the biggest criticisms from those who support President Trump's mandate is that these are people who disappear, that they don't come back for their hearings. But we understand that these parents are being equipped with ankle monitoring bracelets.
Yeah, so most of the parents who are released have ankle monitors, but it's also a misconception. It's a myth that people evade their immigration hearings. There was a program that this administration ended, the Family Case Management Program, mm-hmm. that even the private companies that run the detention centers, they conducted the data. And with the support and the guidance for these families, over 99% of them, 99.6% of them, showed up for their court hearings.
Yeah. Look, what happens to, it seems like the biggest sticking point right now, there's a smaller group of parents that the government has decided are unfit to have the children. They may be criminals, or maybe they aren't the actual relatives of the children. But it seems like the biggest sticking point is the hundreds of parents who left the country. What happens if they can't be reunited? We understand some of them left thinking their children might get a better chance if they stayed behind and even went into the foster system. Is that one of the paths here?
Well, it's up to a parent to ultimately make a voluntary and fully informed decision. I find it very hard to believe that hundreds of parents made that decision. And we know that at least our clients who have been deported did not. They were misled. So for the government is going to make the argument that these parents voluntarily left their children, I would like to see videos of those conversations to make sure that there was no coercion, no duress, and that the decision was indeed voluntary and willing.
And the government did say this week that 127 parents declined to take their children back and were deported without them. And we're hoping that they would go to relatives in the U.S. But as you said, you'd like to hear those conversations. Efren Olivares, a lawyer with the Texas Civil Rights Project there in McAllen, Texas. Efren, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, the busiest cruise port in the world is about to get bigger. This month, the Port of Miami signed its third agreement with a major cruise line in recent years to build a new terminal. MSC Cruises will join Royal Caribbean and Norwegian in building new terminals, each to accommodate their larger ships. Chibeli Herrera is tourism reporter with the Miami Herald. Chibeli, welcome.
Thank you.
And I see cruise ships occasionally. They're already huge. Why do they need to get bigger?
Well, the cruise lines are really trying to attract folks who haven't cruised before. I mean, that's really the market that they're going after. And the opportunity with larger ships is that you can put more things on them. And they're always trying new things in terms of what they can put on a ship. And really, nothing is off limits. A Norwegian ship just added a giant go-kart track to the top of their ship. So the larger these ships get, the more that can be added onto them. And maybe someone who has never sailed before will see something that they think is attractive and they'll recognize it and want to sail for the first time. And so we have seen over the past several years, it's been going on for some time, that the ships have been getting larger and larger.
How big are they at this point?
Well, the largest ship in the world is going to be Royal Caribbean's Symphony of the Seas, which is about 6,700 passengers at maximum capacity. MSC's ships, which are coming a little later down the line, those are going to be 7,000 passenger ships. Norwegian has some 5,000 passenger ships. So they're pretty huge.
But I am surprised to hear that Miami would need to build new terminals to fit these huge ships, since it's already the biggest and busiest cruise port in the world.
Yeah, Port Miami is extremely busy. I mean, it just broke a record last year. 5.3 million passengers came through. They were expected to go up to 5.4 million this year. But the problem's been that the terminals are a little bit older. So, for example, in 2009, when Royal Caribbean debuted its Oasis class ships, which were at the time the largest in the world, we didn't have a terminal here to fit a ship of that size. It was groundbreaking, the size that those ships were coming in at. And so Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale did build the terminal. And those ships in that time have gone to Fort Lauderdale instead. And while Fort Lauderdale's port is quite a huge port and does welcome many passengers, it doesn't have the fame that Port Miami has as sort of the cruise capital of the world. You hear that a lot. So the novelty with these new terminals is that they will now finally be able to bring those ships back through Miami.
I imagine also that no company would make this kind of investment if they didn't see a future with a lot of people taking cruises. Who is taking cruises right now? Why are so many people doing that?
The amount of people who take cruises every year has gone up steadily, and the demographics are changing slightly. For a long time, it was an older crowd, but now we're seeing a lot more families taking cruises. We're seeing millennials are getting increasingly more interested in cruising, perhaps for the value, for the places that it can take you. Like we've said, cruising has the ships have gotten bigger, and for some people that's a deterrent, but some ships have gotten smaller too. There's also a major push for smaller sort of expedition cruising, where you go to places that you otherwise wouldn't be able to reach, or you wouldn't be able to go to definitely on a big ship. Cruise lines are really focused on making it about the experience, whether that experience is on a very large ship where you can do a multitude of things, or on their private islands, which they've also put a lot of focus on, or on the ports that they go to and the kind of tours that they offer in these areas. I mean, for many people, cruising is a very good deal. You get to go to many different places. You only pack once, and that's attractive for many travelers.
Are there environmental concerns about these new, larger ships?
Yeah, there has been environmental concerns for a long time. Some ships have been caught dumping contaminants into the water. There was a big lawsuit with Princess Cruises several years ago And so that is a concern. And so many of the lines are starting to move to liquefied natural gas to power the ships. We're seeing a lot of the new ships that are on order coming in as LNG ships, which is going to be a lot easier on the environment. And so it's obvious that cruisers care about it enough that the cruise lines are now actually doing something to change that, as well as maritime laws.
That's Chibeli Herrera, who is the tourism reporter with the Miami Herald. Chibeli, thank you.
Thanks so much.
House Speaker Paul Ryan said today he would not back a move by fellow Republicans to impeach Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's been accused by some conservative members of hiding information in the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Well, meanwhile, the 2018 midterms are around the corner, and our next guest says put the focus on thwarting further Russian interference. Clinton Watts is a former FBI agent. We spoke with him yesterday about Russian interference. Last year, he testified before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, telling them that rigging one election isn't the Russians' goal. It's taking down democracy itself. He is now a senior fellow with the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. We invited him back today to tell us how he thinks the U.S. is doing in thwarting interference. Clinton, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
Just last week, Microsoft executive Tom Burt said they recently foiled spear phishing attempts from Russia aimed at three candidates of note running for re-election this fall. What's your sense of what's happening going into the midterms?
From the Russian perspective, they're just going to continue what they've already been doing, which is infiltrating, gaining access in terms of hacking to targeted individuals, creating what they call compromising information on targets, and then later deciding whether they want to influence in one way or another. For the most part, though, it's not going to be covert in 2018. It's going to be overt. You're already seeing Vladimir Putin essentially talking in terms of perspective to a U.S. audience in many ways. His popularity has grown significantly within certain conservative audience segments. I think moving forward, what they're going to look to do is to continue to put pressure on the United States, try and build alliances, but also trying to weaken the United States from within. And they're not so much going to try and hide this. They'll be rather overt about it. And I think you saw Vladimir Putin say that in Helsinki. Yes, I wanted President Trump to win.
Well, but we're also seeing, you know, lawmakers on the right side of the aisle horrified by this. So you spoke before the Senate committee a year ago. You made recommendations. Are you saying that it's useless at this point, that it doesn't matter anymore because it's becoming more overt? Or is it still worth trying to stop the online attacks and the fake news and all the other things that you've described?
There's two parts of it, and one is going better than the other. The first one is what I call election integrity defense, which is can we make sure that the voter rolls and the voting systems are defensible against hacks, that we have some sort of reliable backup, which I think should be a paper ballot backup, so that American confidence in the institutions and in the process, the democratic process of voting, remains strong. This is one of the key things they pushed at the very end of 2016 going into the election was election-rigged voter fraud. Regardless of who won the election, they wanted to create the perception in the American public that you could not trust the vote. Because if they can wear down Americans about the actual confidence in democracy, that is their ultimate goal, that democracy isn't the best system that's out there. If you look back, the Senate Intel Committee that I testified to, Senators Harris and Lankford actually put a very strong bill together, and you've seen DHS look to make election infrastructure essentially protected infrastructure and working with the states. It's been slow, but at least it's moving forward. And so I feel pretty good about that. The part I don't feel good about is the influence effort. The U.S. government has not mounted a sustained or organized effort to counter influence. And that comes from the very top. That's a leadership decision in the White House, which is how are we going to stop this sort of influence? And instead, you've even seen whether it's the White House or now in the Senate, some of the senators that came back from Moscow use the moral equivalency argument that Putin would argue. Everybody does this. It's not that big of a deal. That is essentially what Russia hoped for in the beginning, is that they could use these moral equivalency arguments. But I'm not aware, nor have I witnessed any effort where the U.S. has undertaken widespread hacking campaigns against not only U.S. citizens, but former U.S. officials like Colin Powell, Secretary Clinton, stolen their information and dumped it out on the Internet. And until there's some sort of leadership decision, I think all of the institutions, they're going to be left in a stalemate where they can't really move forward because no one's told them to.
Well, but the U.S. has tried to influence elections of other countries. Are you just saying not to this degree?
Well, I think there's a big difference between putting a Voice of America broadcast together that's pro-democracy. These things are overt. We say that we're doing that. We're trying to promote democracy around the world. I am unaware of this moral equivalency argument that I hear that everyone does it. Well, it essentially opens the door for all countries to try and influence our election. Mm-hmm. So if you're EU and NATO and you're hearing U.S. senators say, well, everybody does it, we're not that worried about it, then maybe you would say, well, I want to keep EU and NATO together. Maybe I should influence U.S. elections as well. It can create a very chaotic environment where nobody can trust any information. And in that system, that's where Russia wins. Well, that's the breakdown of information, you know, what is fact versus fiction.
Talk a little more about what you saw, ginning up racial tensions, ginning up distrust of media.
There's four general themes that they will always push in a Russian influence effort. The first one that they tend to go with is social issues, which is identify both sides of a social issue and see if you can divide up the electorate along race, ethnicity, religion, social economic status, and really get them competing against each other. Black Lives Matter is a great example where you saw some of the Facebook pages they set up were, I think it was called Black Matters US. It was essentially trying to bring people in that were supportive of these sort of racial movements and then use those also to send to people that were against it and say, look what these people are doing. And then use those tensions and use that infiltration to push people towards political messages. And those really stacked up as four, and they were very clear, I think, in the outset. The first one was anti-Clinton. The second one was very pro-Trump. The third one, which Russia really created through hacking, was Bernie Sanders got a raw deal from the DNC. And here's the hack material. You can see it. And the fourth one, which was rather minor, was we still have to show up for Jill Stein, with the overall equation being let's turn down Democratic turnout, you know, and support and try and up support for Trump. Mm-hmm. It's sort of blended set of narratives that they put together. And that's why you'll see them actually infiltrate on both sides, the conservative side of the U.S. and the liberal side of the U.S.
Well, you've said that you're comfortable with how states are preparing for the election as far as the actual election process itself. You've also said that one of your concerns is an overt interference. President Trump has invited President Putin to the White House. But what about the cyber attacks? What about stopping that kind of influence? Who owns this? Is it the government? Is it Twitter and Facebook? Who does that?
Right now, no one owns it. It should be some government and some social media. In the government, there needs to be some entity that is designated by the president from the White House that says, hey, we're not going to allow our population to be moved, duped, enlisted in the efforts of a foreign government to essentially move our electorate to their more authoritarian ways. The FBI and DHS, you know, are really focused on the hacking component of it, but their job is not to protect American minds. There needs to be some sort of task force put together that puts out these roles and responsibilities and figures out what we're going to do in terms of making the public aware. On the social media side, they could do a lot to restore the integrity of their systems, and that comes down to fact versus fiction. People don't know what to believe or where it's coming from in social media. You've seen Facebook make a lot of changes, I think, over the last year. You know, more let's go back to cats and kids, more community, more pictures, those sorts of things.
Well, but Mark Zuckerberg is also coming under attack for refusing to ban outright lies from Americans.
Right.
So that's still an ongoing problem. But is it possible to stop what Russia's doing?
I think so. Awareness is the first ingredient of it. And we did this during the Cold War. The U.S. Information Agency had that mission. People were aware of what they were looking at. Social media makes that even harder because the platforms are designed to quickly get content uploaded from users and have it spread around the world. And the platform is also designed to give people more of what they want. So if you're a fake news peddler, whether you're a nation state or someone trying to make money off ads, you just design content that gets people to click on it, and that's how you get a return on your investment. What the social media companies can do, which I've advocated for, is I call it nutrition labels for information or information consumer reports, which is the way to stop fake news is help consumers make better decisions. So I think every information outlet should essentially receive a rating on two axes, fact versus fiction and opinion versus reporting.
So who does that? The government?
Definitely not the government. The government shouldn't be involved, you know, with free speech. I think it should be an independent agency.
So it's something like the film industry has an agency that would give it an R rating if it was fake.
Right.
Clinton Watts, do you have faith in the 2018 midterm elections?
Yeah. There's another part of the 2018 election that I think people are sort of skipping over in the media discussion, which is what does Russia want? At this point, they've really achieved just about everything with the exception of sanctions relief. They've gotten their play in Syria. They look strong in Ukraine in terms of what they want to achieve. EU and NATO have declined. Russia sits in a very good position right now for a very small effort at very low cost. So for them to be very aggressive, I think, moving forward would maybe be an even bigger reach that could only, you know, hurt them in the end.
What do you make of the president's recent tweet that Russia is going to be interfering in the midterm elections, but on behalf of the Democrats, because he's been so tough with the Russians that they hate him?
Yeah, I think this is a positioning in 2018 to rechange the narrative around Russia. And I wouldn't be surprised if the president really tries to position this over the coming months as, I'm tough on Russia. Russia wants the Democrats to win. Let's change the narrative around it so that when 2018 comes around, we launch a different investigation where we look at Russia supporting the Democrats. Russia, from their perspective, would only laugh at this because that would only further their cause of breaking up the unions inside the United States, creating chaos and advancing the system.
That's Clinton Watts, former FBI agent, cybersecurity expert. Clinton, fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, truth ratings for social media, a government information alert on Russian influence. Your thoughts welcome. HereAndNow.org. And there are heat waves across the country, and that means the unthinkable. Parents forgetting their children in sweltering cars. So far this year, there have been 28 confirmed heat stroke deaths of kids in cars. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie explores how memory works and how, yes, forgetting your child could happen to you.
One day in the summer of 2015, Eric Stuyvesant was driving and talking business on the phone, and he forgot to drop his son, Michael, at daycare.
You know, I looked up and I saw the exit that I needed to get off at about a mile out, but I got engaged in the conversation and how we were going to resolve some issues. And I drove right past that exit and I drove home.
Focused on work, he walked into the house and he continued with his business for an hour, then 15 minutes more. Then something shook loose in his memory. Michael.
I raced out to the car, and he was in a profuse sweat. His breath was extremely labored. His blue eyes, he had the brightest blue eyes that started to turn gray and were rolling back up in his head. And I pulled him out of the car, and we ran into the house. And all I could think was to take the coldest shower possible to get as much heat out of him as possible.
By the time paramedics brought Michael to the hospital, his temperature was still 104, even after the cold shower. He would ultimately have 6 strokes, but he survived. Stuyvesant still wonders, how did I leave my child in the car? Turns out, it's pretty easy.
Attention and memory are very fragile. They all have very strong limitations. They don't work nearly as well as we think they do.
Edward Golub is a psychology professor and an expert in human memory at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He says thinking your children are too important to forget is dangerous. Most people can be distracted very easily.
So for something, events that are dramatic, especially in the outside world, such as a very loud sound, that will capture your attention, no problem. But if you're focused on something else, something that's more subtle, and you throw in a little bit of stress into the mix, and that can make it even less likely to remember what's most important, you know, your child is in the car.
Golub says we tend to go into autopilot and do what we've always done. So if there's a change in our routine, our brains still want to follow those well-worn paths. In Stuyvesant's case, he usually dropped Michael off at daycare before dropping his wife at work. On the day of the accident, he drove his wife to work first, and he intended to drop Michael off next, but his brain wanted to go home after leaving his wife's office, because that's what it usually did. Golub urges people to use this tendency to go on autopilot to their advantage and to safeguard their kids by making checking for them part of a daily routine.
For example, when I put the kids in the car, I'll walk all the way around the car and just look through the windows. That serves to just imprint in my mind that the kids are in the car. And if you have that imprint in your mind, that can make it more likely to remember to take them out of the car. And then also, whenever I get out of the car, I do the same thing. I just verify that they're not there.
You can also make it a part of your routine to leave your purse, your briefcase, your lunch, or your phone in the back seat with your child, whether the kids are in the car or not. It has to be something you always do every time you drive for it to become part of your autopilot process. Michael's dad, Eric Stuyvesant, agrees.
Just check. Even when you think they're not there, check.
For Here and Now, I'm Bonnie Petrie.
Home sales in Southern California dropped last month, the worst performance for June in 4 years. This matters because California is one of the largest housing markets in the U.S. and is seen as a good predictor for the rest of the country. Overall, home sales were also down in June, the fourth consecutive month of decline on a year-over-year basis. At the same time, the median price of existing homes reached an all-time high, $276,900. Joining us now is Aaron Terrazas, who's a senior economist at the online real estate database Zillow. He's in Seattle. Aaron, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And how would you describe the housing market right now?
Well, if you think about the housing market over the past 3 to 4 years, it has been very much a seller's market. We've seen the combination of strong demand, young adults in particular feeling better about their economic circumstances, going out and buying homes, starting their families. At the same time, supply has been very tight. Sellers have been a little bit more reluctant to sell than they have been historically. New construction has not picked up to the same degree as it has in previous cycles. All of that has contributed to rapidly rising prices. Our most recent data show that home values increased about 8% over the past year. That's substantially above its historic pace. So, you know, it has been this seller's market. There are a couple of early signs that perhaps it's starting to shift a little bit back more toward buyers, but it's very early days still.
And what do you think are the reasons for that shift?
I think there are a lot of reasons. First and foremost, interest rates have begun to rise. They're up about 40, 50 basis points since the start of the year. Second, I think when you talk about that demographic rebound of young adults who delayed starting families, buying their home during the recession years, I think kind of that has been a phenomenon of the past 2 years or so, but we're moving toward the final act of that phenomenon, that cyclical rebound, if you will, in young adult homeownership is moving kind of toward its last wave.
And when you look across the country and you've got all the access, I mean, everybody who's got a home either up for sale or that they want to buy, they can see the Zestimate from Zillow. When you look at what's happening all across the country, which region is doing the best right now? Is still a very strong housing market?
Well, of course, the best depends on where you stand. As far as a home seller, the Western West Coast cities are seeing the fastest home value appreciation. In a place like Silicon Valley, home values are increasing upward of 20% on an annual basis.
Still.
20% off of a over $1 million base. So San Francisco, San Jose, Los Angeles are still seeing very strong home value appreciation. But there are other places where home value appreciation has slowed, places like Denver, like Portland, Oregon, in the West Coast. And you also see some very kind of rapidly appreciating markets in places like Dallas and Nashville. Tampa and Orlando have seen strong home value appreciation over the past year.
And what about on the other end of the spectrum? Which areas are starting to show some real weakness?
Well, I say kind of it's not necessarily weakness, but rents have come down across the country. If you look at the pace of rent appreciation 2 or 3 years ago, we were talking about how quickly rents were growing. Now, in most major cities across the country, rent appreciation has come down below 3%. Nationwide, it's around 2%. In a place like San Francisco or even Seattle, rents are slightly negative year over year, down kind of a couple tenths of a percentage point over the past year. We've seen a lot of new construction, new apartment building, combined with kind of easier demand on the rental side. That means there's not as much pressure on the rental market as there was 2 or 3 years ago. That's good news for renters.
Where is it a buyer's market right now?
There are kind of a handful of buyer's markets around the country, primarily in Midwestern cities, upper Midwestern cities. A place like Detroit, a buyer is going to have more bargaining power. But I think more than across the country, it's important to look within markets. And where buyers have the most purchasing power right now is at that upper price point. There are a lot more luxury high-end homes on the market than there are buyers for those homes. And that's where buyers will have the most negotiating power.
According to Freddie Mac, the average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage rose to 4.57% in June. It was just above 4% in January. How high do you think that's going to go in the next year or so, and what do you think that's going to do to the market?
That's right. Mortgage rates have been on the increase, and early data for July suggests that mortgage rates have come down a little bit, given up some of those gains that we saw in June. But there's no doubt that there is an upward trend in mortgage rates. For your median home nationwide, you know, every 25 basis points, every 0.25 increase in your typical mortgage rates adds anywhere from $20 to $30 on your monthly mortgage payment. I think kind of by the end of 2018, by the end of this year, we'll see mortgage rates around 5%, a little bit below 5%.
Which is still historically low, we should remember. I mean, back in the early 80s, you could be paying 17% on your mortgage.
That's a great point. Kind of 5% by historic standards would still be kind of among the lowest mortgage rates in history, the past few years aside. No one really expects them to get up to the double digits as they were in the 1980s.
What about inventory? In my neighborhood, I see condo buildings going up all over the place. And I think in a lot of places in this country, that is happening right now. Are we oversupplying or overfilling the supply with a lot of inventory that there won't be enough people to buy those places?
The story about inventory kind of really varies so much at the price point and at the market you're searching at. New home and existing home inventory, kind of your classic single family houses, that's still very tight, very low by historic standards. By contrast, as you note, we have seen a lot more condo and apartment construction. And you know, in some respects, cities in the United States have figured out how to build condos and high rises, and they've kind of figured out how to build luxury suburban homes. But it's that missing middle that we haven't figured out how to build, you know, townhouses and family style living arrangements that are not large suburban homes.
Why do you think we haven't figured out how to build that? There's clearly demand for that, isn't there?
You're right. I think that's kind of where there is the most demand. It requires so much kind of coordination among kind of developers and landowners. It's just a much more complex regulatory process. It's relatively easy to put up a single high rise in an already dense area in order to convert kind of a mid-density neighborhood into, you know, townhouses. Often generates a lot more community pushback.
Housing starts, which are basically when people start to build a home, those fell last week to the lowest level in 9 months. Do you expect that drop will continue?
You know, housing starts, I think they're going to kind of pick up a little bit, but nowhere near where they need to be. Home builders have been gradually increasing capacity and adding new units, but they're facing a number of cost headwinds that just make it so much more difficult to build. And that's why as home starts have inched upward, they're still pretty low based on historic standards. Talk to any home builder, they talk about rising labor costs. It's hard for them to find workers with the skills necessary to build homes. And they also talk about materials cost. They talk about lumber tariffs and how that's pushed up the cost of one of the most important inputs to home building. So home builders are definitely struggling with costs right now.
Now, you've said that rents are coming down in some areas. How would you describe the rental market right now overall?
In general, we've seen the rental market shift nationwide over the past 2 years from a situation where there was a lot more demand than there was supply to kind of a market that is much more balanced. We've seen kind of so much, particularly apartment rental construction, come in over the past few years that there are a lot more options for renters out there on the market. However, it is important to note that rents are still high. When you look at the share of income that goes to the typical rent, it's still well above the historic standards and well above the 30% that most financial advisors recommend people dedicate at most to housing costs.
So, Aaron, we all remember that it was the housing market that really got us into the Great Recession, about 10 years ago. Do you think that we are at risk of that happening again, that we've seen prices go up so much, so many people get loans to buy homes? Do you think that that could happen again soon?
It's important to keep in mind kind of what drove that housing boom and bust a decade ago, and lending standards were at the root of that. It was the ability of people to get mortgages far beyond their financial capacity to maintain. We haven't seen that type of lending over the past 5 years. After the crisis, of course, we enacted a whole new set of lending rules that prohibited a lot of that type of lending that we saw in 2003, 2004, 2005. So I don't think kind of lending standards are as lax as they were a decade and a half ago. I do think kind of the housing market is kind of confronting its own set of challenges, and there are unique set of risks unique to this decade, not the same risks as we had a decade and a half ago. I don't think overbuilding is the main risk. I think prices are the main risk right now.
That's Aaron Terrazas, who is a senior economist at Zillow. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you very much.
NFL training camps are kicking off this weekend, and there's still a major issue hanging over the league. President Trump raised it again when he spoke to the VFW convention in Kansas City on Tuesday, drawing cheers when he said, "We stand up for the patriots who defend America.
And we stand up for our national anthem."
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And where do we stand, no pun intended, on the national anthem protest?
Analogy, and it might be a little bit of cliche. The NFL is trying to change tires on a moving car. So they know they have a problem. They think, there's some debate, but they think it affected ratings and viewership. If not money, we should also note, because the Green Bay Packers are public, so we know what their books are, and they made more money last year than the year before. So I understand that the owners felt they had to do something, and that's all they did, something. And the something they've done has changed a few times, and they did it without input of the players. And the last big thing was they told all their teams, okay, there's going to be this requirement that you stand or the players stay in the locker room, so file what your penalties are going to be. Every team has to do this individually. Miami Dolphins file the paperwork. It's public. And it causes a huge kerfuffle. And it's not that the penalty was onerous, I suppose. They said up to a 4-game penalty for this. But the blowback was so severe that the NFL pulled the plug on the whole experiment of punishment and said, well, we are not going to go through another 31 PR disasters when every team tells us what its penalty is going to be. And now they're just rethinking the whole policy.
Do you think we'll end up with no policy like this in the end?
They have to have a policy, because no policy will just open them up to all sorts of criticism. I mean, they are getting criticism from the players, and they are getting criticism from the media. I just think, to use another car analogy, I think it's been kind of a clown car. Mm. I think that they haven't really thought about this in a systemic way, and they haven't gotten all of their stakeholders, you know, all the players and all the owners and the networks all together to work out something. And you've got to think that, well, other leagues like the NBA, but other competent organizations on the level of income that the NFL is, would have found some way to do something. So they've kind of tried to do everything, and in the end, wound up doing nothing.
Okay, so we'll wait to see what the players do in the fall, you know, what they're going to do when the games actually start. But we want to note another issue on the sports page, and I just want to do a shout out to Dallas Mavericks coach Rick Carlisle, who's known to be a mentor to women sports writers and athletes. And he hired a woman, Jenny Busick, to serve as an assistant on his staff. She's not the first female assistant coach in the NBA, but this is a pretty small club. And it's a club that was rocked, the Mavericks, by that Sports Illustrated expose about their hostile, toxic for women environment, you know, the former president, you know, leaving and everything.
Yep.
So kudos to Rick. So comment on that. But is there ever going to be a female head coach?
Yes, and I think it'll be Becky Hammons, who's the current assistant of the Spurs, and I think it'll be within the next 3 years. She was interviewed a couple times this year, which is a step. And if you look at the history of Spurs assistants, they're the most admired team in the NBA. They might not be the best. I mean, obviously the Warriors are the best, but as far as head coaching and management, they're admired. And all of Greg Popovich is the head coach. Mm-hmm. His assistants routinely get jobs in the NBA because, you know, it's a fertile ground for talent. And Becky Hammons is right there as one of the top assistants. And to further your compliments, Rick Carlisle is known as one of the most progressive mm-hmm. and thoughtful and smart coaches in the mm-hmm. NBA. Dallas has a female assistant. The Spurs do. Come on, Houston Rockets. All in Texas can have a female assistant.
Mike, a lot of golf fans were pretty excited the other day with Tiger Woods, who was on the leaderboard in a major golf tournament for the first time in years. He ended up tied for sixth in the British Open. But is he back after all these years?
If you asked me a couple years ago, I'd say no. And the word back would be primary in my explanation. You know, it's very hard to come to. Injuries are hard, but back issues are especially hard, and especially for golf. But given his greatness and in the past, and given his work ethic and given his athleticism and his commitment to working out, such a commitment that, you know, they have to actually tell Tiger to calm down sometimes. It's plausible. It really is. Now, arguing against that are a couple things. He last won a major championship in 2008. And there have been golfers that have gone as many as 11 years between championships. Ernie Els between 2002 and 2012, that was his gap. And one of the reasons he wasn't winning during that time is because Tiger was. But it's hard. It's hard to have that kind of layoff. And also, golf has changed. So it used to be older guys weren't so disadvantaged in the sport of golf. But there are, because of Tiger Woods, all these young, athletic, buff players, or, you know, slightly buff in some cases, who are great. And I think the competition is going to be tough. On the other hand, golf is one of these games where there are a lot of vagaries to it. And I wouldn't say it's out of the realm of possibility. I still think it's a long shot.
Mike Pesce, we got less than a minute, so I'm going to throw one lightning round question. Say something about baseball. Something, anything we should pay attention to.
It's become a sport.
33.
It's become a sport of home runs and walks and strikeouts. And the ball needs to be put in play more. I love baseball. I love statistics. But there's just not enough action for a sport that wasn't known for its surfeit of action even 5 years ago.
Okay. Mike Pesce here, now sports analyst, also editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
What if he had more time? That's my what
I know,
if.
It would have been amazing.
Who knows what he would have said?
Unbelievable.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now.